son in Canada, and a great first experience in Canada, of course, is PI, so it's really awesome to be here. I'm going to basically speak to you about a couple of things. First of all, highlight the results that were on the archive today of the STSS2 supernova survey, and just highlight those in the context of cosmology and also looking to next generation surveys and what it means. I'll then discuss photometric supernova cosmology with beams as an answer to how to handle large data sets in the future. And then I'll just briefly discuss what should we expect to see dark energy dynamics in the next 10 years. Okay. So, of course, this wasn't work done alone. As Bruce mentioned, I was a student in Cape Town, and this is work, beams is work done with Bruce and with Martin Kuntz at the University of Sussex, and then various other people, Hubert Limpeitel, Bob Nickel, Matt Smith, Adam Rees, Bridget Falk, and the STS2 supernova collaboration. I'll then discuss the BBN and scaling constraints at the end, and this is done alongside with Bruce and other students at the University of Cape Town and the ICG in Portsmouth and the University of Sussex. Okay, so in order to put everything in context, it's really cool to see how supernovae and supernova cosmology has evolved in the last 10 years, because it's been around for roughly that long. So in 96, the first analysis of type 1a supernovae, in fact, showed no conclusive evidence for dark energy at all, which was sort of what was expected to be found, which is great. Then, of course, a couple of years later, the HiZ team and the Supernova Cosmology Project, with better data and more data, actually found the rather surprising result, of course, that we lived in a universe which was dominated by some form of dark energy that was, you know, roughly 70% of the total energy budget. And that started in the supernova community a drive to, of course, get more and more data and to refine these results. And up until last year, the kind of state of the art was Essence and the Supernova Legacy Survey. And you can see here, you know, starting to fill out the diagram and beat down the systematic errors, we start to constrain parameters a little bit more, and the results come out, you know, consistently at, you know, this is, of course, assuming a flat universe, roughly 75% of dark energy. If we bring that forward to 2009, the Constitution data set incorporates a lot more of the data, pushing out to slightly lower and higher redshift. And again, the errors continue to decrease as we start to understand systematics in the supernovae. So, yeah.
So the key point is that the final one doesn't assume flat. That does have still flat. But it does have BAO that can be
exactly, whereas all these analyses have assumed flatness just a priori. But one thing that you'll start to notice that's apparent is that there's this sort of gap in redshift space in the Hubble diagram, and this is exactly the region that is filled by the STSS survey. Okay, so hot off the press just this morning, a few papers about the first year results of the Sloan survey, and I thought I'd just briefly highlight them. So this is quite a cool mosaic of images of supernova from the Sloan survey. And what it is is a 2.5 meter telescope, scans the sky and roughly 300 degrees every 2 days. So it has quite a high cadence and picks up these supernovae. They expect in total to release about 500 supernovae in the 3 year data set. The papers that were released this morning are considering the first year analysis only. So about 103 exactly 103 spectroscopic supernovae. And you can see in this diagram, exactly confirming what I showed you before, you have a nearby sample of very low redshift supernovae, which are taken using wide field cameras. They can't probe very far in redshift space. And then there's this high redshift component, which is sort of small field of views where they're probing very deep. And the great thing about Sloan is that it fills in this gap really nicely, and allowing us to constrain different models of cosmology as we have more data to understand just exactly what is happening in the Hubble diagram. The key idea behind distances of supernovae is you're measuring a relative distance. So we want to understand how spaces change between the sort of near redshift sample and the high redshift sample. And that's key in understanding how the cosmology propagates into the supernovae. Okay, so what are the results? Well, the thing to take from this, first of all, on the top plot we have the kind of nearby sample and only the Sloan supernovae. In the bottom sample we have all the supernovae where they've collated all the data available, including the new Sloan data. What you can see here, the blue curves are the 1 and 2 sigma confidence levels in the W, so assuming a constant W, and omega matter, so again assuming a flat universe. And you can see here, if you combine the data with all the various other probes, like for example BAO as the pink lines and the CMB constraints from the shift parameter, you can constrain W and omega matter quite nicely. And the best fit using MLCS in all the data shows that you have W of about minus 0.76, plus or minus 2. So this is quite surprising. This is not what was expected, of course. If you see here, you've got a minus 1, plus or minus 0.1, and the two sigma contours lie outside of that region. So that tension was something that was quite remarkable when it was first found out. And the main idea of the Sloan team was also to pin down what's happening with this. What this plot I'm going to show you next is using a different light curve fitter to do the analysis. So the light curve fitter takes you from the data that you get on the sky to the cosmology, the distance, luminosity distance, and the distance modulus. The key idea is that these two fitters, which have been developed for supernova analysis, have never been directly compared on the same set of data in a very systematic way. So Sloan systematically did the analysis on all the supernovae with the different fitters, and they find the following. When you use the SOLT 2 light curve fitter, this tension between W is minus 1 goes away. And you get to W about minus 0.6 as a marginalized bound.
So this is just the parameter for CMB?
So this is the shift parameter from the CMB, and the dashed pink lines are the BAO constraints. So these ones on their own are the supernovae. But you can see, if I toggle back, you can see how the constraints shift as you use a different fitter. And so, of course, you don't want to start saying things about dark energy and saying, oh, we have a significant detection for W not equal to minus 1, unless we really understand these systematics. And so there's a lot of work that's gone into understanding just where these systematics could come from and what the assumptions are in the different fitters. So the key idea is in the assumptions made in the fitters themselves. They, of course, were developed independently. And it boils down to the bands, the assumptions that are made into light curve fitting of the particular bands. So imagine you have a supernova that's giving off light, obviously with a range of wavelengths. These get translated into colors on the telescope as the light passes through the various filters. The way the light curve fitters work is they're trained on a low redshift sample, okay? And of course, various assumptions go into the low redshift sample to train for higher redshift objects. The MLCS filters are trained predominantly on low redshift, so where all the supernovae are in the U-band, which is quite blue, in their rest frame. And they assume that all changes in the color happen as a function of dust extinction in the galaxies of the supernovae. SOLT, however, fits for its light curve fitting parameters, which explain how the supernova is changing with redshift, how it's changing with dust, for example, and they fit for all of those with the cosmology at the same time. And so they have this parameter beta, which basically is a fit parameter, which is going to take your template light curves and fit them to the light curves that you get at high redshift, and they assume it to be constant. I won't go into the details of that. But what you find is if you allow it to evolve with redshift, you find significant detection that these supernovae are actually evolving. So it boils down to a difference of assumptions in the two fitters.
But you have more free parameters.
So in MLCS, you also have a stretch parameter. So they also they are free parameters in MLCS as well.
Yeah, but are there more?
I think they're the same number, although I'm not entirely sure of that. I think you have the same in both, but I'll have to check.
Because what you say up there seems more strict than the down seem to be fitting for all these things, but the up you're assuming is
So you put in MLCS, you put in more sort of more prior information in terms of like the extinction law, and so it's sort of rather than fitting all the cosmology and the parameters at the same time, you put in different priors.
So you have more priors.
I do think SALT gives you better looking fits because you then do a global minimization of the scatter. So SALT will make it look, even if it's rubbish, potentially.
The problem is that SALT, yeah, exactly, those parameters are minimizing scatter around lambda CDM. So, you know, you're sort of inputting a model.
You actually build lambda CDM in SALT?
Well, as far as I know, the parameters are on the low reach of sample, are the scatter is minimized around lambda CDM Hamel diagram. So you know, there are pros and cons for both.
But I think this is the same with a lot of cosmology. For example, if you do the baryon oscillations, you should recomplete the power spectrum for every single cosmology, possible cosmology. But they only do it for lambda CDM. Mm-hmm. And so then people go and use it for different models. Mm-hmm. It's not strictly true. Mm-hmm. So I think it's just computationally difficult, so people take the easy route for recomp. I think it's essentially all cosmology data. Is essentially
so you're saying that basically you're just putting the parameters on lambda CDM.
So yeah, and so as long as
the best fits,
exactly, so
of lambda CDM.
Effectively, or maybe it's like a kind of WKD approximation where these things would change slowly with you changing your underlying cosmology, and so you kind of just fix them at their lambda CDM values. But no one's actually checked. I think
the assumption is that the scatter in the Hubble diagram is not huge for these parameters, but yeah, exactly.
I guess the K corrections, it's the same thing. You assume lambda CDM to be your K corrections.
So basically, I cannot anymore use the Hubble diagram with other models I have.
If they're close to lambda CDM, I think you can, with some error. But if they're very far away, then probably not.
If you want to fit for different models, you should actually take the data itself and then compute everything, you know, systematically from start to finish, rather than taking the data from a paper, for example. And then fitting it.
Are you saying nobody's doing that?
I'd say a lot of people take the data from the papers, right?
I don't think anyone's done that,
but it's your data, actually.
So the Sloan paper, they fit everything systematically. So they fit all the data with the two parameters. I mean,
the stretch and what are the two parameters?
In MLCS, you have your stretch and your delta M15 analog, basically. So if you add the, if you say, well, look, we have these problems with the U-band or these assumptions, and so the thing to do would be to blow up your systematic error, because there are things that we don't yet understand about the different fitters and how the everything propagates through to constraints on your cosmology. And if you add these systematic uncertainties, the discrepancy goes away. So these thick lines are your total uncertainty. And so here you can see at 68%, things are getting closer to agreement between the two. So what we've seen in this paper and in the data is that Sloan has added to the supernova cosmology state of the art by not only adding more supernovae in the redshift regime that we need to have them to understand the different effects, but also for the first time has looked at the fact that there are these systematic errors that potentially have been ignored up to now or maybe underestimated. And the key idea is that there's a systematic flaw that needs to be pushed down, and there's a lot of work that needs to be done in supernova cosmology to understand that. The key idea that I want to show you here, of course, is this is a plot of all the supernovae that have been discovered as a function of redshift, and you can see quite nicely again just how Sloan fills the gap. The key point is that if you look on the axis at the numbers of supernovae, you see that we're a relatively small number of data still. Even after 10 years, it's been really difficult to get a lot of supernovae with spectra. And so the question is, okay, well, what about the next generation? We're about to enter the next decade for supernovae. What's going to happen and what's important? So if we say, well, let's take all the supernovae that we have already and you know, come up with a nice parameterization, a nice simple explanation for what they could be, we'll use a rabbit. Okay. Current supernova surveys have around 1,000. And the key idea here is that you only use a supernova in your data analysis if it has a spectrum. So if you're absolutely sure it's a type 1A supernova. The problem is that an LSST, the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, expects to find of order 250,000 supernovae per year for 10 years. Okay, so you go from a rabbit to a blue whale. Okay. Now, of course, we want to use this for cosmology. Having all this data where you're not entirely sure if you have a type 1A, we know we'll probably only be able to get about 1% of these data. We'll only be able to get spectra for them. So either you cut a rabbit-sized hole out of a blue whale and throw the rest of the blue whale away, or you have to find a way to use this data in a robust way without confusing your cosmology and biasing your results. Okay, we won't be sure that all of these are type 1As, and we want to find a way to use all the data without biasing from this possibly contaminated distribution. Okay, and this is where BEAMS comes in. So just to recap the state of the art, surveys like Sloan, so these are Sloan light curves, they take images on the sky, as I said, you know, every 2 days, and they get points in the different bands for the object. They then have these templates, and they say, well, how can I do, what is my chi-squared fit to the templates? And you can see, for example, that it's these G-band curves that tell you, okay, look, it's not a type 2, it's more likely to be a type 1A. From this chi-squared, you can derive an effective probability that the data point is a type 1A supernova, just in the standard way. The key idea is that none of these points are used, as I said, unless they have spectrum. So here's a salt spectrum taken of a supernova, and you can see the key feature that identifies it as a type 1A is the silicon 2 absorption line. Once we have that, we're sure and we use the data. With LSST and surveys like LSST, we'll be completely swamped by supernovae and we won't be able to get spectra for all of them. So we're going to have to understand how the probability that they're a type 1A comes into our analysis. So as an example, as a schematic, here's the 103 spectroscopic supernovae that are in the papers released today. And we'll color them by probability that they're a type 1A. So all these points were 100% sure they're a type 1A, and so we'll color them by blue. I'll show you a quick animation. what I'm going to do is plot the same data and add to it all the good photometric candidates from Sloan. So they have, you know, of order two or three times as many data points, as many candidates that they think are probably a type 1A with high probability, but they don't have spectra for them. Okay. And I'm going to plot them on the same diagram, but this time color them by that probability. So as they go towards more yellow and white points, the P of 1A, probability that they're a 1A, increases. Okay, I think that's done. And so you can see, of course, the ones that are very highly probable to be a 1A have a tighter scatter, which makes sense. But we want to be able to use all this data without clearly biasing ourselves away from the true cosmology. Okay. So another schematic, imagine if you had this contaminating distribution, as I said, was the points that were not assumed, confirmed to be 1A, and you have some distribution that you want to separate them out. BEAMS is just that. It's Bayesian estimation applied to multiple species. Here we assume that we have two species. One are the data points that we know are type 1A, and we can use them for cosmology in the standard way. The other are this contaminating distribution, which we assume are going to be biased away from the same distance modulus. And with BEAMS, we want to do our parameter fitting using a posterior that weights two contributions. Firstly, we have the likelihood assuming it's a 1A. So this would be the likelihood that is used, you know, a priori in other analyses. The key idea is we say, well, we want to weight that by the probability that that data point is, in fact, a 1A. and we include a likelihood, assuming it's not a 1A, so it'll have some shift in distance modulus space, it might have a bigger error as a population. There are various nuisance parameters you can include, and we weight this term by 1 minus the probability that it's a 1A, assuming you have two populations. And that's the key idea, is that this weighted posterior is now what we use to do our cosmology fitting.
I'll just make a comment that this is the right way to do this. You know, you could think of a million different ways to do it. This is the right way.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Isn't it in some cases better just to throw away the things you're pretty sure in lots more ways?
If you do that, that's really bad. It turns out because you throw away things that actually are one. The problem is you don't know. So if you do a cut, for example, you say, I'll only take things that are 95% sure be 1A. So we did some simulations. And you get big biases, actually surprising. So in fact, you have to include all the data. You should include all the data.
I don't even know what these likelihoods are.
So that's what Renee sort of went over quite quickly. You've got the light curves. So do you want to just go back to those light curve points?
Sure.
So those lines are templates that we've got from low ridge, where we know what they are. Mm-hmm. So for example, left is a type 2, a supernova type 2 template.
Yeah.
The right is a supernova type 1A template. And just doing a chi-square, you can get an estimate of the probability in each case. So you can see those blue points are terrible fits to the type 2 template, but pretty good fits to the type 1A. And so from this is how we estimate the probability of being 1A.
The template looks itself pretty noisy.
Exactly. Fortunately,
is that an average over many? Or
exactly. Well, so an average of a few. And of course, the beautiful thing about LSST is that there'll be huge data, huge amounts of data. So,
will there be huge numbers of reliably identified low redshifts?
So, getting the low redshift ones, we should be able to get quite a lot because then we'll be able to use very small telescopes to get the spectrum. Mm-hmm. But that is a good point. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But still, the question remains: how do you get the probability of like being one? Yeah. Are you assuming?
So,
in error bars or?
No, we in fact, sort of the light curve that is will give you a probability. It might not be perfect, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. But
what is a minimum chi-square probability?
Okay. So, yeah. Well, exactly.
And you can calculate chi-square for the model on the left and model on the right. And then the difference gives you the probability.
The relative probability.
Assuming Gaussian.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So, how to get good problems is definitely an important question. But assuming you know it, then I think this is the correct Bayesian way to do the analysis.
Exactly. And in fact, if you have some indication of what you think the probabilities are, even if you didn't get them completely right, beams can actually marginalize over those as well. So one of the questions is, well, what if the observer completely gets it wrong and thinks that this is the type 1A? You can actually marginalize over that inside beams and reduce that bias as well. So one of the key ideas of applying it to Sloan was to say, well, we know that there are 103 confirmed spectroscopic points, and we also know that there are a large number of good candidates. So can we apply the beams formalism, to the data and see how much better can we do? How do the constraints change as we include these photometric points?
What is beams? What's
that? So beams is the statistical algorithm that we developed. So.
Sorry.
I should have made that a bit clear. So this is work with Martin and Bruce a couple of years ago, where we outlined the formalism simply for a toy model case we just described. And in fact, it's multiple species because you're not restricted to, you know, type 1A or not. If you have enough data, of course, you can include all the different populations of supernovae and et cetera. Okay. So we're applying this algorithm to the Sloan data. And we want to know, well, how does beams change the results? So just to bring it home again, we're going from the traditional Hubble diagram, which is distance modulus, which is, of course, related to your cosmology as a function of redshift, and we're going from that, a two-dimensional picture, instead to a three-dimensional space, where we have not only the distance modulus and redshift, but we're also including this information on the probability, and that's going to add another sort of dimension to our parameter space, which will help us to constrain our parameters, gives us more information.
Is that an actual sample?
So this is the same distribution. I've just now plotted them out in probability space.
So yeah, it's coupling the spread between zero probability and five probability.
Exactly. And one of the things you'll see is, you know, there are some effects that we need to, of course, consider as well with these points, but I'll get to that in a bit. So these are preliminary results, but if we take as a base comparison, we want to say, well, how well can we do compared to the standard spectroscopic case, which we know, if they're all type 1As, we should be getting the same result. And so this, we're going to be, for this talk, using a lambda CDM cosmology with omega lambda and omega matter, so not flat, lambda CDM. Okay. So if we naively apply beams to all the data, this is the ellipse that we get. Of course, if this was the end of my talk, you would not believe beams at all, or you wouldn't, because we see that there's a shift from the sort of test case spectroscopic only sample. And so one might ask, well, why do we get this ellipse? As a comparison, we can say, well, what if we applied the standard treatment, so don't include any of the information about the probabilities, assume all the data are type 1A, and then do the analysis. What results do we get? And there you can see you're much more significantly biased away, which is not surprising. What we want to do, of course, is include the fact that we know there are effects that we can see in the data. This is the plot that I just showed you. You can see there seems to be some sort of some photometric redshift effect potentially in the sample. We know there are various selection effects we need to include. And so the great thing about beams is that there are ways of including these systematics. So if we reduce our sample size slightly and say, okay, for the time being, let's assume that we don't have a supernova spectrum for each of the data points, but we have a spectrum from the host galaxy in which they found, so that we know that at least the redshift, we're pretty certain about the redshift. If we do that and we include some nuisance parameters, we find that not only does beams lie on the curve that I showed you in the beginning, but also we have reduced the size of the error ellipse, okay, by about 70%. And that's just including the 291 points as opposed to only the spectroscopic sample. Yes, so you're including as a calibration the spectroscopic sample, but you're also including the other data. Exactly. The thing about this is you don't have to tell beams that they are a type 1A. Beams will figure it out by the fact that they fit very well. So here you're assuming all the probabilities are 1, but we know that some of the ones that have been confirmed to be a type 1A had light curves that didn't really look like a type 1A. And we can include those probabilities without making any a priori assumptions.
So you're debating everything that doesn't fit? Is that everything? Yes. Is that?
No, yeah. I mean.
So if you remember the likelihood that we had, the beams posterior, there are two terms. The one is the likelihood, and the other is the probability in both cases.
Yeah.
So of course, each point can contribute to the posterior either by having a very low probability or a very bad fit. So if it's a type 1A, its likelihood is going to be very good, and so we can include the probabilities. We don't have to make any assumptions. Conversely, if it's not a 1A and has a high probability, we'll expect it to do very badly.
There's no fitting, there's no discussion about how far away from the best fit is it when you're doing the parameter estimation. But you can afterwards say, what's the posteriori probability of being 1A for any point? So, for example, we can take the 103 spectroscopic and confirmed object and ask beams to tell us what it thinks those are. And in all cases, it says they are 1A. So it's able to actually, without knowing about the spectra, table to correctly identify the objects.
So you're not using any information about how likely it is to be 1A?
Oh, yes, here we are. Yeah.
Here you are.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you could reverse engineer it. You could say, okay, let Beams tell me how likely it thinks the point is to be a type 1A.
Okay. And you get the same number as what you
assume. And in the case where they are a type 1A, Beams agrees. So, which is, of course, very useful for exactly that thing we were discussing. What if the light curves look very much like a 1A, but they're not? You don't want to add extra information.
So, yeah, we don't get the same probability as what we put in. So, for example, there's some spectroscopically confirmed 1As that had like a 1% probability of being 1A. But when you ask Beams afterwards to tell you what is the probability of being 1A, it will tell you it's 99%.
Mm-hmm. Because it fits on the...
There, it's looking at the fifth of the... But that, you don't have to do that for the parameter estimation. None of that's required. It's just useful to prove that Beams is
No problem. Thank you. And for comparison, this, of course, is the ellipse I showed you earlier, just the kind of naive analysis with all the data points. So Beams allows you to reduce the size of your ellipses by saying, okay, we basically have an ineffective. We have more supernovae than before, where we include, okay, the total number of spectroscopic points in the total sample, but we also have the number of photometric points weighted by their average probability. And so that's the essence of Beam. It allows us to, in an unbiased way, reduce the size of our error ellipses and watch the space for more on that. But finally, we just would like to say, well, we're spending a lot of time pushing down the statistical error bars. The key thing with LSST is how are we going to use all the data available to do cosmology and to reduce the size of our error bars to understand, are we living in a lambda CDM universe? Do we detect dynamics? And these are all questions which Beams aims to answer. But one might say, well, given all the systematic work going into reducing the systematic error bars and work going into reducing the statistical error bars, should we be surprised if we still don't see dark energy dynamics in the next 10 years? And I would answer, no, we should not. So again, this is work done with Bruce and the other students in Cape Town. And to summarize, we showed that early universe constraints, so constraints on the amount of dark energy allowed at early times, if we assume a scaling model for dark energy dynamics, basically tells us that we should expect dynamics to be essentially invisible for the next decade, even if the dark energy is dynamical.
When you say scaling model, are you assuming it's a very slowly scaling dark energy?
So in this particular model, which I'll go into a little bit later, we're assuming that you have a double exponential potential, so you scale at early times and then break away. But we're not...
So it's only scaling at early times?
Exactly. There's some redshift at which the dark energy starts to dominate. So we have that there are constraints from early universe probes, such as nuclear synthesis and the CMB, which tell us that we can't have more than 5% of dark energy at early times. This is because it would affect the expansion rates of nuclear synthesis, for example, and change the abundances. So the key idea here is that scaling models allow you to propagate that constraint through to late times when the field exits scaling. So here's a schematic, for example, of one such model where we have the equation of state of the dark energy scaling with radiation in the radiation era, so about a third, and then the matter era, and then eventually breaking free and starting to dominate. And we use the double exponential potential, where this potential controls the scaling. You fix the value of lambda to get scaling at early times. And then this mu, you can vary to get different behaviors at late times. So that's the key point. That early universe bound translates to late universe and allows us to say, well, not only do we say we have a limit on the amount of dark energy at Z of 1,000, but we have a limit on the amount of dark energy at Z of, you know, between 1 and 10, for example. What do these models look like? In our particular parameterization of the double exponential potential, we allow we allow two forms. Either we have mu greater than zero, or we have mu less than zero. Mu less than zero will give us an oscillating W at late times, and greater than zero, you'll have this slow, smooth drop at late times. And we allow for a variation in mu to ensure that we have roughly consistent bounds with late time dark energy, so W less than minus 0.8. So we want to know, well, how do these constraints from the W of Z propagate into the observables, the things that we measure, such as the Hubble parameter, the distance modulus, or the luminosity distance. And they, of course, come through the energy density. So here are those same models. The colors correspond to the same models, where we've now worked out what is the evolution of the dark energy density as a function of redshift. And you can see we fixed the models to reproduce 0.7 today. There's a spread with redshift, and then they're asymptote to that bound that we get from early universe constraints. Just for reference, the lambda cesium energy density, of course, just drops with redshift. And so we go from this to our observables by saying we know that the dark energy density will change the expansion rate. So we define the expansion rate, the Hubble rate of our model relative to lambda cesium. And we say, well, what do we expect the deviation to be? What was really surprising is that even in the model with the largest value of W today, we only get about 5.5% deviation from lambda cesium. So even though these models are physically very different from lambda cesium, they will only appear to deviate at about the 5% level. If we then say we want to be more conservative and we want W less than 0.9 today to match late time bounds, this gets even smaller. So we don't expect more than about a 2.5% deviation in these models. We can, of course, think of this in the context of observations. So future baryon acoustic oscillation surveys expect to get roughly 1% measurements, say it's a 1 and 3. So if you think of that within the context of this deviation, we're not expecting more than you couldn't get more than 2 sigma detection of dynamics.
W of 0, but how do you know what W of 0 is?
So in this plot here, we just propagated, so we chose a value of mu in the exponential potential, and then just evolved the field and derived a W. Okay.
Another way to put it is, models with W bigger than minus 0.8 probably would have been ruled out.
Well, but that's a question. So you're either using the current data or you're not using the current data. So
approximately using
it. Because you see, the thing is that if you're not really using the current data, then you don't even know if universe is accelerating today or not. So, but if you're using the current data, then it seems that in that means that they do play a role. So then improving them, so the allowed models might be. They must fill everywhere within the allowed region of acceleration. So what I'm trying to say is that you cannot assume that W of zero is anything in this particular one, but the current constraint on, well, at least current constraints on W, you assume constant W, not this model.
I guess what we would say is, given that we detected acceleration 10 years ago,
yeah,
should we be surprised that we didn't detect dynamics last year? Are we surprised that we just seem to be shrinking down on lambda or not?
So, but here's the question. Can you construct a model which is consistent with data, but within 10 years won't be?
Yeah.
Can you construct a model?
A model that's consistent with data.
Right now, but won't be.
Yeah, so
yes.
If you go to the next plot, and it's... Or even the previous one, if you look at those oscillating curves right at the bottom, they have a 0.5% deviation or range of less than 3 from lambda cesium. And that's assuming all the other parameters are identical. So you're not marginalizing over uncertainty and omega matter. So
yeah.
Anyway, sorry.
Sorry.
So, yeah, I'm,
This sounds a bit suspicious.
So these W's, well, these oscillatory double W's are ones where you have the mu's negative. So you have, I can draw it on the board, the potential. Exactly. You have your scaling potential, your late time potential, and so you have W oscillating, the field oscillating around a minimum, and that gives you your oscillating W. And so these models then generate these oscillating H.
I guess, sorry, can you go back to the W's? The key point is that there's no, you can't go up to zero below a redshift of 4. So you can't, the tracking, the scaling can't happen at late time. You're forced to end the scaling at very early times. So basically, since a redshift of 1, nothing is happening. It's starting. And that's the BBN constraint. If you try to push the curves to the left,
but you're saying BBN tells you that you're supposed to be accelerating at redshift 1.
No, the BBN forces the transition redshift to be high.
But it's in that
yeah, but observationally we won't be, we can't go above redshift 1 for the next 5 or 6 years.
BBN doesn't say anything about redshift 6.
Yes, you could. So that would only make it worse, right, in terms of the technical.
True.
So web point is there's a bound, you can't push it to the left. What we would like is for the dynamics to be very strong and below redshift of 1, because then we can detect.
Why is BBN stopping you pushing to the right?
Already you have already put in the 7%.
Because of the scaling. So that's the scaling assumption. So if you drop scaling, of course this all drops away. But the fact that it's scaling means that if omega dark energy is 5% at BBN, then it's also 5% at redshift 6. Because the
where
whole point is omega dark energy is constant. Anyway, you should be able to carry on.
Exactly, no problem.
I'll keep going.
So.
I'm biting my problem.
Related to Niaj's question, are there any models, this is all in the context of a double exponential, right?
Yes.
So are there any models of dark energy, whatever they are, that are consistent with current data, but might have very interesting dynamics within the next 10 years? I think was that the thrust of your question? I mean, it's sort of
distracted
from, right?
Yeah, it's
so maybe these double exponential things can't give interesting dynamics, but it's hard to believe there isn't any model that couldn't do it over the next decade that is consistent with data now. I mean, I don't know what they are, but are there, or how strong a statement can you make?
So, of course, there are other, I'll let you speak in a moment. the reason why we looked at these models, of course, was because you have an early universe constraint. So we were saying, can we link early universe and late universe constraints? Okay. And to do that, you need a scaling model. There are models of dynamic dark energy that are not scaling. For example, you could have dark energy having a sort of kink. But then the early universe bounds don't tell you anything. So if you want to link early universe and late universe, you need to scale. And then, well, that's my statement at least.
If you're saying if you impose scaling, that there's no model no matter what. That's a very strong statement. Seems to be strong.
Well, scaling requires an exponential potential.
But that only tells you what about in some range of phi it's exponential, then
yeah.
You're close to the minimum for anything else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'll call him my collaborator.
On the bus.
No, please go ahead.
So we tried a bunch of other things as well, and it all looks almost identical to this. The one case we are, that you really have to get, you can put a double kink in W. So then you can obey these bounds, but then we actually computed the CMD and it looks terrible. You get a very strong ISW effect. So you can construct fine-tuned models which get around this, but then the CMD doesn't appear to work. So I think the status is we've looked quite hard and we haven't found any models that work, that are consistent with data and which have interesting dynamics.
And which are
scaling. Yeah, without scaling, all of this disappears completely. So,
okay. So you can't be sure to leave there, but you've looked hard and someone else is welcome to try. That's amazing.
Exactly. Okay, so we've looked at the Hubble rate. So one of the things is, well, look, let's look at the distance modulus, which of course is directly linked to the supernovae that we just discussed earlier. So the distance modulus is related to the log of the luminosity distance to the supernova. And we again show all the different models where we compute delta mu, which is again the distance modulus for that model minus the lambda CDM. So we, you know, zero deviation would be around zero. And you see the same models before, where we've overplotted these orange blocks are the current constraints on the distance modulus out to high redshift. Not exactly current, because they don't include the results from today, but they're pretty current. And on top of that, we've shown expected constraints from a stage four dark energy mission. So by stage four, I mean the next decade. So SNAP, LSST, very ambitious projects, which we don't expect to happen in the next 10 years. And you can see, once we go to these types of surveys, the errors get a lot smaller, and one may start to see detect deviation from lambda CDM. But at the current data, any of these could be the real model. Just to show you again, all the oscillating models that we had before fit with a delta mu of less than 3%. So to conclude, I've shown you a bit of the supernova results from Sloan and discussed why these represent a step forward in supernova cosmology. And then looking to future surveys where we will be swamped by photometric data but without spectroscopic confirmation, I've introduced beams to you and illustrated how, using the probabilities, we can reduce our system, our statistical errors and our constraints on various parameters. And then hopefully convinced you that even though we may not see dark energy dynamics for the next 10 years, it wouldn't be reason to stop looking or to stop coming up with models that suggest that, because we don't expect naively to see deviation, at least in the form of scaling models, for the next 10 years. Thank you very much.
Any more questions?
I have one. So you said there will be 250,000 supernova per year with LSST.
Optimistically.
So what would be the constraints on W and based on if you use beams?
To be honest, I haven't actually computed that. That's a good number to throw around in the next talk. I haven't actually computed that exact number, but I'll have to get back to you on that. I would have said.
So is the quality of these photometric data, will it be similar to the SPSS one?
They expect it to be a lot better.
Better.
Because I think from what I remember, it's about 40. They expect about 40 light curve points per supernova, which of course will be, you know,
so,
much less noisy.
So then, very conservatively, it's the same. Yes, one of our
2,000.
Yeah.
No,
but
that's the used already. That's all. Oh,
so you just
mean
like
in your thing you use
300.
So we, yeah, we.
100 is
too much material.
So 300 and that's 300,000.
That's per
that's
year.
Per year for 10 years.
Yeah,
but
will run. So the statistical error will be
100 times as
okay. So what's interesting, why I think this is one of the reasons important, the Dark Energy Task Force did an analysis of, you know, what we should do. And they did, they assumed 300,000 supernova clusters. But they assumed that some magically we knew that they were all 1Os. Because they didn't include contamination at all. And if you allow even 0.1% contamination with that number, it drives you your cosmology completely. So beams may not be the best way. Well, I think it's the best way. So there may be another way to do it. But something like it is.
But there'd be a lot more spectroscopic data too, which you would
not
have to check beams. Is nobody finding that spectroscopic?
Well, we're sort of checking it with Sloan. That's the reason. So we're not so interested in doing it with for Sloan because we've got 3 times more supernova. It's not really that extent. So it's really using Sloan and dark energy survey and maybe PanSTARRS where we'll have spectroscopically confirmed there. We can develop the formalism. And then
PanSTARRS will do spectroscopic.
You know, but there's sufficiently few that we'll be able to get for that.
So you said if there's 0.1% contamination that drives it way off.
Yeah, that's
how off, how way off.
We have a plot that we probably not easily.
I could bring it up.
It's around for,
yeah.
Not in a realistic case, but in a toy model, we've done some surprisingly.
Let me open this one instead, sorry.
Let everybody's talk here. No, it's not
really. Oh, look, sorry.
So salt does work, somewhat. That's a salt spectrum.
That's a salt spectrum.
Exactly. So
no, it's not
that's there. Not there, sorry. But yeah, one of the key points to make is what a lot of people assume is that they say, okay, if we're 99% sure, we'll just take everything, assuming it's a 1A. And that's the whole thing. If you want to cut out the bias, you're going to, if you want to reduce your bias, you know, to less than 2 sigma, you're going to have to cut out almost all your supernovae, and then you might as well be using just the spectroscopic.
Yeah, but how bad would the estimate of W be if you were 0.1%? I mean, how off is
so? So in the toy case that we, the plot that I wanted to show you, of course, that I don't have, we found that at about 1% contamination, we were more than 2 sigma away from the true input value.
1%.
1%. 2 sigma. So, and it, you know, it doesn't drop off.
To put it another way, there were 4 objects that, from the probabilities alone, we thought were 1As in Sloan, but which spectra showed were not 1As. So roughly 4% in that contamination from the light. So if you know, you said these dead things are definitely 1As because they're more than 95% sure to be 1As, we roughly have 4% contamination from things that weren't. And you can see the points are way up the Hubble band.
Yeah, so that thing that's blocked by that, yeah, that thing there. So the blue color means probably not 1A, and yellow means probably 1A.
A lower probability, yeah, exactly.
No, yellow means high probability, right?
Yeah, yellow means probably 1A.
Probably 1A, exactly. This, so this is low probability, yeah. Yeah. The interesting thing, though, is exactly what Bruce is saying. There's some points which are classified as not a 1A, but they're really close to the fit. And also, if you have the other contamination where you think something looks like a 1A, but it's not, even if you have, you know, a few percent on 250,000 is a lot of contamination.
So can these statistics accumulate over time, that as you get more and more of them, you can be more and more precise about what is and what isn't? So it's going to have, so it gets better every year in some sense.
I think so, because the templates will get better and better every year.
Exactly. You update the template. So if you had 3 points to do a chi-squared fit, you'll get a certain value. If you now have 40, in the larger limit, you'll be more precise. Exactly.
Plus, in terms of learning about the systematic errors, it's clear that we don't really understand what it is. And so, as you get more and more data, your ability to understand and parameterize what's going on, the variability will improve.
So, how about intrinsic as matter? Do you assume there's one single template for one A's, or there's really a range of templates?
So, So at the moment, they take averages over a few templates and then just take that as the template. Of course, that wouldn't be the ideal way to do it. You'd want to include the scatter in the template as well. And that's something that Bruce and other students have looked at.
But it's not built into being...
At the moment, no. I mean, at the moment, we say, well, the observer gives us a P1A, some probability. There is work going into saying, how can we improve how we get those probabilities and make it more robust? Thanks.